Hi everyone. Before we get into the show, I want to tell you about something that I received an invite for. It's a tribute to Leonard Nimoy. It says, Remembering Leonard Nimoy on his birthday with John Tuentu. T-E-N-U-T-O. I'm terrible with names. Anyway, the point is that they're having a tribute to Leonard Nimoy on March 26th, that's a Thursday, at 4 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Mountain, 6 p.m. Central, and 7 p.m. Eastern. Since the UK is currently 4 hours ahead of Eastern, it would be 11 p.m. UK time on Thursday, March 26th. Obviously, the Google Plus link is very long and convoluted, so I encourage you to please go to trekmatefamily.com and look for a post I put on it that will have the link. Or you can go to lewtrekshow.com and you'll see it as either post number one or post number two. Check it out, please. And I hope you are going to watch. This is a public event and it will be on Hangouts On Air. So, once again, Thursday, March 26th, 7 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. UK. Go to trekmatefamily.com or lewtrekshow.com and check out the information. Thanks, and let's go into the show.
You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to the Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek: The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Up the Long Ladder. I'm Data from Bremerton, Washington.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. And I'm not in love with Comcast. All right, we're just going to have to suffer. You kind of have a little, I don't know what to describe it as in your voice, but we'll just have to live with it. So, Data, welcome back. You know, you were just on, jeeminy, about 1, 2, 3 episodes ago.
The one that was released late.
Yeah, the one that was released late. That is so true. Yeah, that was my...
James mentioned I had a tendency to come on with Melinda Snodgrass episodes, and I guess she'll stop writing for TNG, so then I'll stop being on the show.
Right. Yeah, I doubt that. I mean, she may stop, but you're not going to. Why would you? Okay, so you want to come on. Why don't you tell a little bit about yourself again for people who haven't heard Pen Pals yet?
So has anything changed?
Has anything changed in 3 weeks?
No, I'm still the same me, although my name changed since I was born. I was such a big Star Trek fan, I had my name legally changed to Data. I, in addition to watching all the shows and films, I also read all the novels and comic books, which we've talked about sometimes.
So, when you get pulled over by the police and you give them your ID that says Data Logan, do they ever go, or nobody gets it, or?
Well,
he's been pulled over by
the police. That's a trick question, right?
What, guys?
That's James picked up on it. It's a trick question. You're asking me when I get pulled over by police as if that happens.
Yeah, I think the similar one, a question that gets asked in England a lot is, when did you stop beating your wife? I mean, it's a horrendously loaded question that you can't really answer very well.
Okay. Well, James, when did you stop beating your wife? When did you start beating your wife? I don't see you as a wife beater, James.
Well, thank you, Lou.
You're welcome.
Such a compliment.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, anyway, I mean, it's got to be interesting. I mean, okay, so when you cash your paychecks, says Data Logan.
It's all direct deposit nowadays. You never have to talk to people about that. Anyway, so I get your point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. You know, some people don't bat an eye, don't think about it. Mm-hmm. I think I've told you this before. You know, I have a little bit more reaction from people who are fans, people like yourself who know Trek, and they're like, whoa, you actually did that? You went that far? And then, because they have a relationship with Lieutenant Commander Data, and it just, it seems weird to them to have a relationship with a guy who in real life was Lieutenant Data, U.S. Navy, you know?
Actually, Data, for a second there, I thought you were going to say, I usually find it harder to have this discussion with, you know, Star Trek fans who may or may not have their own TNG review episode podcast.
Maybe, maybe not. Okay. Well, that's fine.
I hate the fact that I could get on with you guys and review TNG without having to have my own podcast. Oh. It's nice that I don't have to get over that hurdle.
It's fun to do.
And you even put up with my crappy internet connection.
Actually, to be honest, if truth be told, I think I'm probably a lot closer to you, Data, than you imagine, because all I do is I turn up every week and I have a chat with Lou. Lou does everything else on the back end and all of the editing and anything, you know, all of the posting and stuff. I don't really have my own podcast. I just get invited onto Lou's show a lot. I see it like that.
Yeah. Next week, you just might not be here for Manhunt. It'd be me and Colin, which actually was going to be me and Colin for the show, but it didn't work out that way. So, talk the second fiddle. I got to stop talking now. Why don't you go into that synopsis before I make it worse?
Synopsis for tonight's show. The Enterprise discovers two threatened colonies which must cooperate to survive. This is the 18th episode of the second season of Star Trek The Next Generation. Original release date, May 22nd, 1989. Written by Melinda Snodgrass, directed by Winridge Colby. Guest stars include special appearance by Diana Muldaur as Dr. Pulaski. Guest stars are Barry Ingram as Danilo Odell, John DeVries as Wilson Granger or Victor Granger, Rosalind Lander as Brenna Odell. So what do we think of this episode? I think it's got a lot of good, interesting concepts that just get muddled and make it sort of crazy.
Mm. I mean, if I can go next, I think that's a polite way of saying it. I think at its core, right, there are lots of things going on, but it's a bit of a car crash in how it gets put together. And I'm, you know, when I realized that Data was coming on for this show, I know that we're going to be talking about some of the stuff that didn't get to the screen in a particularly nice manner. So, you know, being analytical like that, I'm sure we're going to go on to it. But I think that this episode had a, you know, much greater potential than really what got executed in the end. Mm. How about you, Luke?
I think Melinda Snodgrass probably thought, you know, those Irish people, they are so funny sometimes. We really have to find a way to put them in the show. And then she found her most typical cliché-ish Irish person to help her write this. And it just kind of turned it into a farce, actually.
Apparently, it wasn't her idea for the Irish.
Mm.
Yeah, that was her boss, the head writer. The one who gets fired after the second season. Well, I don't know if he got fired, but he leaves, right? The same one that had friction with the actress, or Gates McFadden, right? Yeah. So all that, I mean, she had the general concept, but the Irish all came from him. And he is Irish, so I don't know.
Best intentions. They were funny. I thought they were kind of funny, you know, but they tried to be funny. And some of the situations that even like Picard says, you know, sometimes you just have to bow to the absurd. And in that regard, I thought it was a pretty good story, but it's so cliché-ish.
I think so, maybe...
Sorry, Lou, before we get into this too far, should we head over for some forum feedback?
Oh, yeah? You must like those forum things, don't you? Okay. Well, then, my goodness, where'd we leave off? So we left with 14, which is the Icarus Factor. The Icarus Factor. Daddy beams aboard, and I'm going to really give him an earful. Or, you know, in a... What's those things? Sticks called, whatever they're called.
Ambujitsu,
yeah.
All right, now before we go into tonight's forum feedback for the Icarus Factor, I made a mistake in the last one for Samaritan Snare. We were going to record forum feedback, but James seems to think we actually did record the forum feedback. So if we did, you're going to be hearing the same feedback again. If we didn't, well, let's go ahead and do Times Squared. And we're going to, of course, start up with Kieran McDuff again, who says, always good to hear from Colin, even if he is a potty mouth that needs to be bleeped out. And I'm glad it was rephrased so I could at least work out what he had to say the first time. Well, I try to leave some of the word, but anyway. I usually like a good time travel story, but since this wasn't a good time travel story, I'm quite happy to agree with the three of you on this episode. I've never understood why Picard is unconscious and why everything seems to be negative and out of phase. That never happens in any other time travel incident. Was it something to do with the way he traveled through time? Indeed, why is the El Baz thrown 6 hours into the past in the first place? Did they ever actually explain what happened? I don't think they did they?
No, not really.
I think they figured out that it was some kind of entity that wanted him to go back in time to make a different choice for some oddball reason. So anyway, it says, Riker seemed to... You got more?
Well, but then if that was true, then why hassle them the second time? Because they hassled them the second time.
Well, because... So
they hassled the first time the Enterprise went through. They sent Picard back to make a different choice. And then they started to hassle them
again.
You know,
I had a thought about that just now. I'm thinking as I'm going along here. Probably because if it was the entity that was in this vortex, when they went back in time, the entity in the vortex was the past entity that doesn't have knowledge of the Enterprise being destroyed at this time. So he sent the ship back to redo it so he doesn't accidentally destroy it again. Maybe that's what's happening. So the past entity wouldn't know that it sent the ship back in the future to begin with. So 6 hours, well, maybe that's enough to actually make a change. I don't know. That's an interesting question. Does that make sense?
I'll take that.
Well, Riker seemed to bring it up, but it was never resolved. Besides, it's not like the Enterprise was thrown through time when it successfully navigated the energy vortex. Was the time travel something to do with the mysterious entity of the vortex? That's what I was just thinking. Why would it throw Picard back in time if he wanted Picard for itself? Why destroy the Enterprise after you get him? Why let the Enterprise pass through the vortex and go on its way if you're capable of doing all this? What was the makeup of Picard Beta? Why? Why was he made up so much that he looked like a mannequin? Far too much of the episode just happens without being explained. So hopefully I think I have a pretty good explanation as to why they were allowed to go through. Probably some kind of scanner that they have to start at the beginning and go all the way through. So when the ship went through, it got a full scan where it didn't before because it put up a fight. Interesting. I didn't know that Q was supposed to be in this episode, but I could see how it would make a lot more sense if he was the entity and he was setting Picard some kind of puzzle to solve. It would also explain how he was thrown back in time to do over again and getting it wrong. Indeed, that's exactly what happens in Star Trek Borg computer game where Q features. Are you familiar with that? Because I don't know what he's talking about.
I'm not familiar with the game, unless it's that one that happens on Voyager. Where I know that Q's in an episode, in a game that's on Voyager, and you're supposed to click your way through a whole bunch of scenes and make choices. Okay. But I'm not a Star Trek gamer.
Me either. Okay, or a comic person or the cartoon person. But anyway, another question that goes unanswered. If Data doesn't need to eat, but is quite capable of eating, what happens to the food he eats? Humans will process it because we need to live and then expel the waste. So what does Data do? He shouldn't need to process any of it, so does it just pass straight through? Or is another idea of Dr. Soon programmed Data to be fully functional? That's a good question. Where does it go? Is it possible that he could actually turn it into some kind of energy?
Yeah, I think he could. Absolutely, even down to kind of a, you know, the same way the replicators work, right? Where they could take matter and just convert it back into an energy stream. He could possibly have like an anti-replicator in his bowel somewhere.
Ultimately, I think they ripped the heart out of this episode by removing Q, and what was left was a mess of ideas that didn't really feel cohesive enough to make a good episode. I'll give this a 2 out of 5, but it's only getting bumped up from a 1 because it gives Patrick Stewart the opportunity to showcase his acting skills. Weird makeup or not, he did a good job of acting with himself, and that can't be easy. And finally, L. Baz, being a fashion designer. I love that idea. More shuttles should be named after fashion designers. We could have a shuttle craft Versace? What's that word? Versace? V-E-R-S-A-S-C-E?
Versace. Does your wife not force you to buy her Versace?
No. But it almost sounds Italian. Versace.
It is Italian.
Ah. Well, then let me do it with the Italian accent. We could have a shuttlecraft Versace. Although, no doubt, that would get it all shot up. Oh, I don't think so. Versace. That's a good word. That's my word for the day. Versace. So later on today, when I go to my sister's house for my niece's daughter's birthday, I'm going to say, hey, everyone, Versace. Never mind. All right. Go on, Doc.
Do you think the opening scene of this episode would have made the Icarus Factor more enjoyable? Now, by the way, it's been a while. What was the opening scene? This was the food, right? The Riker making breakfast for everyone.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, it probably would have made my anger a little less because of the fact that your father loved to cook. That could have probably been rewritten a little better if this had been the opening scene for the Icarus Factor. Yeah. I think he's right there. What do you think?
Yeah, although like sometimes I wouldn't have minded them having... Well, so the thing that you're competing against, you want there to be context within the episode, but also you don't want it to be the first time it's ever mentioned that Riker has a father in the episode where his father turns up. You know, like, what were the chances of that happening? That, you know, this morning when I went down, and it's a bit like, isn't there a Kira episode on DS9 when, you know, she says, you know, oh, you know, these flowers are my mum's favorite, so every single year I like buy these flowers, and then it happens to be that that's the Kira mum-centric episode, and I don't think you necessarily need it to be that tight. So I think a bit of, you know, just a slightly better phrased opening with acknowledgement that we're coming on to the Icarus Factor would have been fine by me. So then, anyway, so let me continue with Captain Proton. He gives Colin, and I give Colin 5 stars, gold stars.
Interesting, yeah. Well, you know that Ben likes to give 5 stars, so, but he didn't tell us how many stars goes for Times Squared, though, Ben, so you left that part out. Unless, of course, we're just assumed that it's 5 stars, because it always is. All right, so Colin, who was in on the episode, says... He thanks both Ben and Kieran. Did we ever figure out what Kieran's real name is?
Chris.
Chris? Okay. Yeah. Well, he thanks both of them for the kind words. He was a bit drugged up. I was a bit drugged up on meds, as was Lou. I guess I was. So my normal control over profanity was a bit awry. But I can tell you, whatever the doc put in the needle was groovy.
And the final comment is from Blair, who was on the show last week, and he states, "For me, this episode will always hold a special place in my heart, despite its plot holes. As a young boy, I always watched TOS on Saturdays with my mum. As a five-year-old, I thought it was cool, and I was fascinated with the Enterprise, phasers, Scotty, and Spock. So years later, when I was around 12, TNG came out, and I refused to watch it. How could they replace my beloved characters? So I refused to watch. Then one day, while at a friend's house, he put on Times Squared, and I loved it. I guess you could say the rest was history. Now, as an adult, I have sat down with my kids from a very young age, watching the old reruns of TNG, DS9, and Voyager, and even the older reruns of TOS. My daughters still love the Gorn fighting Kirk, seeing the saucer separating, Q, Jake and Nog's camping trip with Sisko and Quark, the Doctor's emergency combat hologram, and of course, the scary Borg. Oh, the memories. Just for getting me into Star Trek TNG and all the following series, I give this episode 5 stars.
Ooh, all right. Well, thank you, Blair. So let's go ahead and go into the forum feedback for the real episode we were supposed to be doing, which is the I Care Less factor, or the Icarus factor. And we can start off with Colin saying, Icarus factor is an episode I like for 3 reasons. One, Riker plays an angst-ridden teen, and so does with a deft hand. What's a deft hand? What's the word deft mean?
Colin's coming on next week. We should ask him what he means.
Oh, we'll probably forget, though.
Don't. off the top of my head, I don't know exactly. I wouldn't know how to Google away.
Deft. Neatly skillful, quick in one's movement. So let's go back and reread it. Riker plays an angst-ridden teen and does so with a quick skill, skilled hand. Dad, I hate you. You don't love me. No one understands me. Or any other teenage rant would have been sufficient in his role for this episode. But as an episode, it relies on the acting skills of the cast in a variety of roles. More than technobabble or special effects, Frakes is a fine actor. Yes, and we pointed out last week, so is Patrick Stewart. For any actor to hold the screen when working opposite a great actor shows how good they are themselves. Even if Riker does have a tendency to put his crotch in people's face when he puts his leg up on a console, the other interesting thing is this episode, as this episode pointed out, is that Pulaski, who only last week knew nothing about Riker's dad, informs us this week that they were very close. Anyway, the second thing is I like about this episode is another insight into the Klingon culture. TNG and DS9 helped us learn an awful lot of the Klingons and their mad, crazy, pain-ridden ways. Worf is upset because, well, you know, because no one has inflicted pain on him this year. Really. I guess there is something seriously major in that blood wine. Could be. The only downside is the person who solves why Worf is troubled is a person who probably spends the least amount of time with him. To me, Data, with his vast knowledge, or Riker, who has a lot of respect for Klingons, and Worf would have made more sense, but I guess Riker was busy with Daddy. Finally, I like Miles in this episode. As the show progresses, he becomes more and more a mainstay. Here he is positively a co-star, and deservedly so. Although there is something to be said about people who will happily stick a pain stick into someone to make them happy. That's all it takes. I'd love to pain stick a few people. Not even a dungeon mistress or leather outfit anywhere. So my score would have been a 3. That's a good point. No dungeon mistresses. All right.
No dungeon mistresses.
Guess not. All right.
So I've got Kieran McDuff's comment this week. Right. So Kieran McDuff posts, "I'm not much of a fan of this episode either, I'm afraid. I'd agree that it's not really an episode that's been done wrong or badly. It's just pretty bland for the most part. For instance, I think the Will-Kyle Riker thing was supposed to be awkward. Kyle seemed far more at ease elsewhere on the ship, and obviously very at ease with Pulaski. So my impression here was that the writing and the direction were for the scenes between the two of them to feel as awkward as possible because of the tension between them. Which is fine, except it makes it awkward to watch as well. Maybe they did too much of a good job. For me, the B plot was far better than the A plot. I just didn't care that Will had daddy issues, and we kind of knew from the get-go that he was never going to leave the Enterprise to command the Ares. The grumpy Worf wanting his pain sticks as a storyline was far more fun, but even that seemed a bit random that he was grumpy about the 10th anniversary of something. I could maybe understand if it was the actual thing, but the 10th anniversary? I'm not religious, so I'm maybe the wrong person to pick on this, but do people actually celebrate the anniversaries of their bar mitzvah, or their first communion, or the age of ascension, or whatever your equivalent might be? I would have thought those events would be a big deal to mark a transition in life, but it's not as if they come around again afterwards like a birthday. Mind you, I do celebrate my wedding anniversary, but then that's a yearly thing and not something that only becomes important at the 10th anniversary. So unless Worf is grumpy at this time of year every year, I'm still not sure I understand it. Now, hey, Lou, you must have been married for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
So Kieran himself, I think he's a youngster. So I suspect he hasn't been married for very long. He probably hasn't got into the 10-year anniversary and the 20-year anniversaries. But I think that as you do, I think you do start marking the 10-year anniversary of your wedding and certainly the 25th year anniversary of your wedding. And that becomes, more than the 27th or the 22nd or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Where am I? Nevertheless, it's another insight into Klingons that expands them as a culture. So I'm quite happy to go along with it, even if I don't understand it. I can see why they might enjoy being jabbed with pain sticks. I'm not even touching the idea of S&M Klingons. If this is what regular Klingons does in his spare time, I don't want to think how far they'll go for the kinky stuff.
Oh boy. Only bites? May not be.
So a great point about the crew being stuck together for so long and how that does seem quite odd in the grand scheme of things. I'd have loved to see more progression for the crew than what we got. Worf's progression was quite slow, but compared to the crew, at least he got promoted a couple of times. LaForge probably progressed well too, but the top three officers, Picard, Riker, and Data, never go anywhere. Mm. Actually, I think that it's something that I always... I must have moaned about in this next episode for it even to be raised in the topic. But I always find it strange that, Data in particular himself, he comes in as a lieutenant commander on Encounter at Farpoint, and he's still a lieutenant commander the day he dies or the day he gets blown up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something like, it's well over 25 years later, right?
Right.
And, if you're working somewhere and you're in the same position 25 years down the line, that does seem to be a bit stale.
Well, but anyway, not necessarily. Two things. One, I mean, there's nowhere for Picard and Riker to go except for leave the ship, and neither of them want to leave the ship. So it's Data's going to have to go somewhere if he wants to go up. And the other hand is he's an android. He has no ambition, so he's probably content to stay exactly where he's at. It's not a big deal.
No, I agree that out of everyone, Data's the guy that has bring time on his side, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't need to have his own command by 40 or whatever it was that Riker. I think Riker wanted to be an admiral by 40.
Yeah.
I seem to recall. So he doesn't have that issue, but it is. I actually would have liked something that gets brought up in Best of Both Worlds when they have Shelby. I would actually would have liked a bit of transition. I would have been more than happy for Riker to have gone off to do his own thing. He might come back every now and again and for the new blood to come to shake things up. But anyway.
You mean keep Shelby?
Oh, I would have loved for them to have kept Shelby, yes.
No. Oh, no. I can't see Shelby sustaining herself as a first officer.
Okay, we're going to have good discussions on when it comes around to Best of Both Worlds, by the way.
I suppose.
And then I think the question then becomes, Shelby's first officer to who? To Picard or to Riker?
Picard.
Because I think the Shelby-Riker interaction would have been more interesting than the Shelby Picard if those two were the top two positions.
Right.
Anyway, we're going off. So, Kieran, if you make your posts shorter, there'll be fewer tangents. That's for sure.
Not a big
one. Anyway, I'm just joking now. I'm sure we'll come to it in a while from now. So, I'm sure we'll come to it in a while from now in a lot more detail, but I've always reckoned Picard should have been promoted to Admiral after the events of the Best of Both Worlds. Actually, I'm really sorry. I didn't read ahead. Yeah. So the stuff I'm talking about, Best of Both Worlds, I'm screwing up his comment here. It never made sense to me that someone with that amount of Borg knowledge wouldn't get a Starfleet desk job afterwards for the good of the Federation. Riker's field promotion was basically erased from history after those episodes too, and it was never explained why he would have gone back to being a commander. Riker should have retained command of the Enterprise, and with Shelby likely moving in on her own ambition, that would have been fine opportunity for others in the regular troop to move up. Promote Data to forward commander and make him first officer, with Worf probably taking the position at Ops as he did when Data was presumed killed in the Most Toys.
The idea of Picard becoming Admiral after having assisted the Borg in killing how many people? I don't know if that would have went over very well.
Oh, I suppose that's true. No, you're right. I mean, there is the knowledge that Picard carries, but also at the same time, and you see it with Sisko's interaction with Picard, who is fundamentally at that point, you know, after Worf 359, he's working on the next generation of warships and stuff. You know, Picard doesn't really sit well, right, as the as the figurehead of Starfleet, certainly with the guys that fought at Worf 359.
Okay.
Anywho, I think if they had done that, it would have been an interesting way to expand the Star Trek universe into stories around Starfleet with Picard. But then again, maybe I'm thinking in a way that a TV works in 2015 rather than how it worked in 1990. And I actually think that is true. TV producers were a lot more keen to expand in the universe in a series that operates than they used to be. The best you could hope for back then was an almost independent spin-off series. Anyway, I think this feedback says it all. Sorry. It's far more interesting to talk about other episodes and how the crew never progressed than it is to talk about anything that actually happens in this episode. I'll give this one a 2 out of 5 for not holding my attention enough. So thank you very much, Kieran, who is coming on early in the third season. Mm-hmm. So I look forward to having him on and getting an articulate Scotsman. Not to suggest the other Scots that have been on aren't articulate.
You think Paul's articulate? I'm kidding. Anyway, I'm going to hear about that one later. You know, an interesting thing about the way TV works. Actually, I was just thinking when you said that, how it works in 2015 rather than how it worked in 1990. I think it would have been a very bad idea to move the seats around, because I think for Patrick Stewart, it'd been like, it would be almost as if, what are they going to do with me now? And it's exactly what Max Grodencheck, is his name, went through when Rom became a, you know, was leaving the bar and becoming a Bajoran engineer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He thought he was screwed. He read that. He thought he was going to be wiped out. I mean, how often do we see Nog now? We're going to see Nog coming up here soon after Rom went on to be an engineer. But, I mean, even, who plays Nog? Aaron Eisenberg. Yeah. He thought it was the death of Nog when he was going to the Academy. So any kind of change on TV is a very scary proposition. You never know what's going to happen to you. Okay, so let's end it real quick with Captain Proton saying, "When I search my mind for notable scenes in Next Generation, the two scenes in this episode pop up. One, Ambojitsu. I don't care if it's not real, but it had me obsessed with getting one of those sticks they whack each other with. Plus, it reminded me of Star Wars and Luke having to lower the blast shield when practicing with his lightsaber. The pain sticks... Number two, the pain sticks.
I sure would like to see if I had the fortitude required to walk that row of Klingons. 5 stars, he says. By the way, to W, B to the W. What's that?
By the way.
But what's the 2 for?
Back, by the way?
I thought back to the W? Back to the way? I don't know. Okay, well anyway. B to the W. I don't think you have to like the Riker-Dat relationship because the acting between the two feels very, very soap opera-like. That sort of acting removes our suspension of disbelief and thus removing our ability to identify with a character. Problem solved. Now build a bridge. So I guess what he's saying is now we've got that past us. It's time for us to go on with life and get to know each other again. Actually, I kind of, in a sense, I don't know if I brought this up for the Icarus Factor, and I probably should have if I didn't, but I kind of like Kyle Riker, the way he was goading William into all these things. It was kind of funny. You know, you could see the looks on his face as he's smiling as Will finally realized how he was cheating all this time. I think Kyle was goating him into all this stuff so they could finally get it out. So, anyway, that was Icarus Factor. And again, I apologize for the Times Squared gif. So, let's go ahead and head on into Up the Long Ladder. Okay, well, hey, thanks guys for sending that feedback. That's always appreciated. Ambojutsu. What do they say? Wait a second. What do they say before each time they... or something like that. I don't know. What do they say?
No, I haven't got it off the top of my head.
Aroshiko. Omogashimasu. Good. Get it all out.
We didn't even talk about that during the show. I remembered that now. We would have said something about... before they start fighting. Anyway, Up the Long Ladder. Okay, Captain's Log. It's dumb, again. And I'm not even at a point where I'm trying to be funny anymore. I'm just writing them. For the past few hours, I've been seeing and hearing strange things on the Enterprise. Riker looks nervous. Worf is moaning and groaning, even more than usual. I even hear suspenseful music playing. This is a mystery. But I think it'll be solved later because we got something much more important that was just tossed in my lap. And that's when we get the signal. What do you guys think of the signal?
It's an enticing, I guess. Yeah. You know? The having this thing. It's nice to get allusions to the rest of the fleet. Right, this signal came in a month ago. Starbase, right? Starbase Church has been looking at it, but it's like, oh, that's, you know, just possibly saving some people's lives. That's sort of low level for Starbase 73, but we'll let somebody deal with it eventually.
Yeah, kicks in a month ago. It takes Riker all of about 14 seconds to figure out it's an SOS, and Riker and Picard gives him good guess. Yeah, it took them month to figure it out. I mean, really, what could it really have been? It's the same repeating signal. It's got to be an SOS. I mean, even Ensign Tommy down at Tech 27 could have figured that out pretty quick.
But it could be a stay away, right? They might have just been a beacon saying, do not approach this planet. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, people have... The crew themselves have put beacons around planets that you shouldn't go near, so... Even if you guess that it's an SOS, you probably don't want to rush in too fast.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, either way, number one should learn more history. So we find out the European hegemony, a loose alliance formed in remember what century that was? 20.
It was 2123.
Ah.
2123 is when the European hegemony supposedly developed.
And where's that in relation to Enterprise, the show?
So this is an interesting discussion point, just because of the timing. Obviously, has been messed up because different writers wrote different things over time. But, I mean, the idea in this episode is that it's sometime after World War III, and, you know, when the world is rebuilding after World War III.
Yeah.
But then it's not clear in this episode if it was meant to be before or after First Contact, right? Later on, of course, the movie First Contact will establish that First Contact happened in 2063, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
So some 60 years before the European economy. So this is part of the reconstruction from World War III and First Contact as the world started to come together. And then by 2150-ish, the entire world was together in a united Earth. And 2151 is the launch of the Enterprise in the Star Trek Enterprise television show.
I get the feel.
That's sort of the timing.
Nice.
I get the feel from this episode that it's supposed to be, well, it is. I feel like the characters fit better in a pre-First Contact world. I don't know. I kind of got the impression that that's what they were going for, rather than the post-First Contact world.
Yeah, I was surprised by how much it actually does seem to fit. And you know, when they talk about it a little bit more, the idea about the European economy didn't last very long because the world government came along very quickly. It was a time of rapid change for the planet as the whole planet was coming together. But you still had these throes of people that were the neo-transcendentalists, you know, who wanted to go back to nature, who didn't want to be involved in the aliens. It seemed like a better fit, actually, for after First Contact. With aliens in the picture, now a lot of those people, some people on Earth would say, whoa, I want to go back to nature. I want to go back to being human. I don't want to be involved in all this technology and this aliens on here near my planet. Very much like we saw in the fourth season of Star Trek Enterprise, right? Some of those humans that wanted to regress, or not regress really, but they wanted to stay away from the aliens, right? They wanted to get back to nature. So I'm actually surprised at how well it fits.
Yeah, no, I can take that, yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, the European hegemony. We need to go find some lost sheep. But first, medical emergency. Klingon down! Now, they rush Worf to sickbay, where she finds out it's, let's see, what was it called?
Lieutenant, you have Rapak Ngor.
But that is a childhood ailment.
Yes.
How shall I live down this humiliation?
Worf, you can't help.
Still, for a warrior to find himself in such a situation.
So you've got the Klingon version of the measles.
How would Commander Riker feel if he had the measles?
Pretty silly.
Dr. Pulaski, how is Lieutenant Worf?
He's in no danger. Worf was just observing a Klingon ritual involving fasting. And he didn't take into account that you have to decrease your physical activity as you decrease your caloric intake. Pulaski out.
So when Picard calls down and asks, you know, how's Worf? Why couldn't she just say, you know, it's private, can't discuss it with you, instead of coming up with this whole thing about fasting and he's supposed to decrease his activity as he decreases his caloric intake? Pulaski out! Don't you think maybe she could have just said, you know, it's really none of your business, I can't discuss it with you?
Well, certainly in today's, you know, U.S. society, with the HEPA, would be the case. I don't see what's so wrong about having measles. What's the big deal? Why are the Klingons so freaked out about that?
Because it's a childhood ailment. I mean, can you imagine a warrior being taken down with a childhood ailment?
Well, obviously he wasn't exposed to it. He spent most of his childhood away from Klingons. I don't know. It doesn't seem that big a deal to me, obviously. But I'm not a Klingon. I don't have their same mentality when it comes to this stuff.
But they also suggest that Riker would be embarrassed about having the measles, and yeah. I'm not entirely sure why that would be the case. So I kind of agree. Actually, two things I would like to point out from like the first. I suppose that the teaser and then also kind of the first interactions here. I actually think the teaser for this episode works pretty well. to be honest. I think they set up this, you know, mysterious SOS call, and I think at this point that things are going quite well, and it's a bit intriguing what you're going to find on this, you know, long lost colony. And then you build, you know, you back onto that, in my opinion, some pretty decent kind of character moments between Pulaski and Worf. And I'm clearly not the best, I'm not the lover of Pulaski, but I thought that relationship really works very well. And there's even shadows of the Spock-McCoy relationship, where you start seeing, you know, Pulaski, you know, ribbing him a little bit, and when she goes off and defines what it means to faint, and, you know, winds Worf up on that side. And I thought that the way that these guys are written together is actually great. Mm. I've never had a problem with how these guys are written together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, though this is sort of the only episode where you see it. I mean, Pulaski's only in another 4 episodes, and I don't know if she has any other time with Worf.
Right.
The whole thing about love poetry, I don't know. We know from previous episodes what Klingon sex is like. You know, the guy spouts love poetry and ducks a lot, right? So I'm like, are they? You know, they're flirting. They're starting to flirt with each other.
Oh boy.
Oh, she's looking for a 4th husband, guys.
Yeah, we should have seen a bruise on her neck or something. Yeah, you know, or something across her face there, or a bandage on her face from when she got bit. Okay, so anyway. Okay, so here comes Data. Net you. I mean, the android. There's no record of a ship that was launched to the Ficus sector, but somebody had to load that ship. And Picard takes this as a revelation. The problem is earlier, they're saying there was no ship launched to the Ficus sector, and of course, records were not the best. And so when Data comes on and says, you know, somebody had to load that ship, and Picard says, the manifest. The manifest on what? I mean, they still don't know what ship was loaded. So what are they looking up to get a manifest and figure out it was the SS Mariposa?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And it's even worse the way it's played out on the screen, because, you know, Data says that, Picard says, he grabs his computer, touches it, once, one button, and somehow the computer knows what he's looking for.
Right.
He didn't say anything. He didn't press any buttons. Well, one. Yeah, I don't know what we're supposed to get from that.
Right, because I don't know how they got to it. That's what I'm...
Yeah, no matter who loaded it, it still doesn't tell you where it's going, and that's the problem. They can't find a ship that was heading for Ficus sector, right?
Right. So, anyway... And like you guys mentioned, another mention of World War III. I Star Trek really believes we're heading for a world war. What was it? Sometime between 2049 and 2053. And then the post-atomic war horror went 16 years, or is it 15 years, or whatever the case may be. But okay.
And then first time, and then everybody started to fix themselves.
Yeah.
It's understandable for, you know, when the show came out in the 60s and even the 80s, there's a lot of Cold War tension.
Right. Right.
You know, I mean, there was reason to believe that we were heading for
war. Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, so, but I like how Star Trek incorporates that. It says, yes, we had some stumbles, we had some failures, but then, you know, we got better. And the implication here, it's not really stated in this episode, but again, I think First Contact changed a lot of stuff. And a lot of this came about after First Contact. But I have another theory that actually puts it back a little more in the human camp and less into the aliens fixed everything camp. But maybe we'll get to that a little bit later.
Okay. Now, James, before we started today, you said you had to bring your wife a spot of tea, right? Remember that?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Did you perform any kind of Klingon tea ceremony with her at the time?
No, I did not.
No. So you didn't give her poison?
No. I merely rushed 2 cups of chamomile up to the wife.
Ah. So she'll be asleep by the time you're done.
Well, probably, but that's more to do with the passing of time than my tea.
Yeah, right. So Worf is a romantic, and Pulaski a suicide Klingon wannabe. Death is an experience best shared. Yeah, I'll try and bring that up with my wife tonight and see what she thinks. So after the Klingon love poetry, do you think Worf got laid?
No.
No. Not right away.
Not
they
right
might away. Have been laying, they might have been laying
laid?
Grounds for something. You know.
Uh-huh.
Tressing it out. What? The whole measles scene, I mean, it really has nothing to do with the rest of the episode. It was just something extra that they threw in here to develop this relationship, to see where it might go, right?
Yeah.
Let's test Worf against the Pulaski, see what viewers think about that. Let's test Worf against Troy. Do viewers like that? Let's test Worf with the Jadzia. Do viewers like that? Right?
Yes.
Yes, I did like that one.
Yes, I like that one. But the Troy Worf thing just came out of nowhere. Okay, well, I guess, you know, for Deanna going a few years, it was a little difficult, so even the Klingon looked good. Wrecker beams down to the fifth planet to evacuate because solar flares from the planet's sun is going to brush the planet in 3 hours. However, Riker's having just a wee bit of difficulty with the colony leader who, never mind that, number one, get them up here. But, sir, no, whatever's going on, we'll solve it here. You're going to regret that, sir. First load ready, Mr. O'Brien, and you're going to love this. Mm-hmm. Six adults, one child, one sheep, one goat, and their pot of gold that the leprechaun bought them materializes on the transporter pad, along with a few buckets, a bag, some bags, even the hay for the pigs, all in one transport. You can even hear a rooster crow. But I didn't see it, though.
Well, it must have came up. There was one later.
O'Brien must have thought, oh, home. Oh, we, it brings back memories.
There was an allusion to him being Irish, but he didn't seem to be playing with it. He's like, I'm not really that kind of Irish.
No.
I don't go that far with the stereotypes.
Uh-uh. No. No. But of course they had to have O'Brien in on the transport, you know. Oh, O'Brien, I knew to be an Irish man to be Mr. Boat. Anyway.
It just seems like they weren't really planning this evacuation very well. They should have beamed up to a cargo bay from the beginning. I mean, Riker went down there. He knew how many people were going to be beamed up, and he knew that they were bringing their animals with them. Even though Picard didn't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it right now. Just do it.
Get them up out.
I'm like, why does it take Picard to say, oh, no, beam them to a cargo bay? Well, of course. Like, where else are you going to put 223 people with two on the way?
Only two on the way. That's odd.
Well, that number sounds weird. I mean, Pulaski said there would be two within a couple of days, right?
Yeah.
So there's, of the 223 people that were beamed aboard, two of them were imminently pregnant. And you just do the math on that. They probably have a lot of babies, but they only have 223 people. This is like the Bakku all over again. If you watch Star Trek Insurrection, right, and you judge by the number of kids that show up on screen compared to the Bakku colony is supposed to only be 300 people, you're like, what the heck is happening here? How are they having so many kids? And the Bakku is even worse, right, because they live really long. They probably never die. They never die, right? So why are there only 300 people? And the same is the case here. They seem to be having babies, but there's only 200 people?
Yeah.
Must be a bad place to live, right? You got a horrible death rate. People are dying all over the place.
Irish tempers. The Irish temper.
We are about eight generations down the line, right? Something like that, I would have thought. So you should have been able to, you know, you could have easily, multiplied countless number of times. You could have been up to tens of thousands with a group of like 200, given eight steps down or so.
Right.
So it is a very, you know, it's still a very small number, unless there, of course, people killing them in the night.
Well, I mean, the planet was undergoing some upheaval, so I mean, it's very possible that they at once had a much larger society. That's just what. This really gets into one of the many sidetracks that this episode has, right? that it doesn't really delve into this whole question about what is it like to give up your technology and go back to nature and live with nature. Well, what you get is horrible death. I mean, that's what living in nature is like. If you don't have technology, you don't have your, you know, medical or they didn't really talk about that in the episode, but you got to think that there's societies, you know, a lot of people die.
Yeah.
And they're just scraping by.
Okay.
You know. But did you get the impression that the episode was wanted to be about giving up technology? Because I kind of saw that as a bit of almost a throwaway line that they had in there. Right. And they do have a lot of throwaway lines, to be honest. They've got this idea of of the immigrant population. They've got the idea of genetics. They've got the idea of of giving up your technology. You've got a lot of these ideas, but I'm not really ever sure what they are actually trying to guide as the central thesis or backbone of the story.
Well, they were wrong about the technology because they said they had all this technology. What did they do with it? They had the wrong people.
No, sure, but we're never told that these guys are living a better life or these guys are living a more pure life. They, by the end of the episode, they're willing to completely be reassimilated into the stuck-up colony with all their their ways of doing things. And I know there's a part in reference to, hey, you both will learn, but I don't think that's good enough.
Right.
It's just like we discussed. I mean, it's one of the many confusing things. I mean, the show is fully about immigration, but in order to talk about that, you first have to establish two different societies. And so, and then just because of Maurice Hurley and his desire to have Irishmen, I think we spend a little much too much time with the Irish society and establishing them.
They were funny.
But I mean, Troy, when they first show up on the planet, Troy calls them unsophisticated. Mm. And there's other words like that spoken in this episode about them. I'm like, just because they chose to give up technology, it seems unnecessarily judgmental. Which I think is part of the point that show is trying to make, is that that is unnecessarily judgmental and that they do have something that they can provide. But we'll get to that later. It's just not done very well.
Right.
And I'd have to say something that kind of bugs me, perhaps probably because we're kind of slightly, we're next door to Ireland. The portrayal of a certain Irish stereotype, and I think it's worse in American television. They always portray a certain way of how that's supposed to be living. And to be honest, you have these guys here, but also when you get to Voyager with Spirit Folk and stuff, you've still got this same kind of Irish that gets projected, and you've got the fiddle music in the background, and this is far, far, far too over-egged in my mind. And this isn't what Irish people look like, by the way.
No,
they're not drunkards that that need to get beaten by their wives or their daughters. I don't quite know where. You've mentioned that the head writer was supposed to be Irish, a proud Irishman, and he wanted to make it about the Irish. But at the same time, the portrayal of the Irish is pretty poor. So I don't quite understand whether this is just someone's idealized view of what, quote, the old country used to be like, or what. I don't know.
Do you think maybe they were ever like that?
Who, the Irish?
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I think this. I don't know the guy in question about whether the.
I don't either.
Maurice Hurley, right? Whether he was Irish, or whether he was Irish descendant. But often there's a tendency to romanticize your roots. So you might be third or fourth or fifth generation from wherever it is in the world, and you'll think back to how things used to be. And sometimes I think sometimes the emigrated population could almost have a stronger opinion of what it's like to be back in the old country than the people that are still there. So I think that, for example, England, I think England's a much more modern country than what is often portrayed elsewhere, just because we always like hark back to how things were you know, with things like Downton Abbey and stuff, that's not the country anymore. But I think that people that had some like English abstraction would be probably drawn to that kind of history.
And I think it's, you know, I have this, if you'll indulge me for a moment, I have this little theory about Star Trek. Being reminiscing about the societies as you think they might have been, right, is not just something that happens on the Star Trek show with the writers and the producers. But I have a theory that it's actually something that is actually happening inside the Star Trek universe. So we went through World War III and First Contact, and then we had this globalization effort, right? And eventually a united world by 2150 in the Star Trek universe. Well, globalization tends to, you know, filter out the differences between cultures. We become sort of a monoculture, right? Everybody's got a McDonald's. Everybody's got a Taco Bell, right? And so I have this just idea or theory that in the Star Trek universe, people started to realize that. They started to get homesick for their own individual cultures. And they, you know, they, like they talk about in this episode, the neo-transcendentalism culture or ideas of let's resurrect the culture from the past. But that they're a couple generations removed from it, so they don't know what it was really like. And they resurrect this fake version of it. And it's, it also explains why, you know, Scotty in the original series was so Scottish, but not Scottish, right? And Chekhov was speaking with this Chekhov accent that wasn't, or this Russian accent that wasn't really Russian, you know? So it's this little theory I have about why the cultures in Star Trek are just a bit off.
And I have to say that, I mean, there is a parallel, by the way, with the United States in that sense, in, you know, the great, like, the great kind of repositioning of the world after the Second World War was the United States getting more and more powerful, and there being a large number of immigration into the United States from mainly European countries. And I think that I would argue that you probably see that as well there, where you can tie certain people back to their original, you know, their original descendants, whether it's the American Irish, the American Italian, you know, the American Jews, as they came across from Europe after effectively Europe was pretty much decimated at the end of the Second World War.
Okay, guys.
Where were we?
Should we go on with the story?
Yeah, we're getting too heavy for Lou. He wants more fart jokes or something.
Yeah. Danielle O'Dell. Just the name is funny.
No. I will give the episode credit for one thing, which is when Worf comes in and Picard introduces him as head of security. And then the guy goes, well, I don't suppose security is much of a problem. That's quite nice.
Yeah.
What?
Then he tries to push his daughter off on him.
Yeah.
Ah, felicitations. No, thank you. And I have no use for felicitations. Thank you.
I had never noticed that he tried to push his daughter onto Picard.
Really?
I don't know why. I always missed it, or, you know, I probably didn't notice it when I was younger. And then I'm not going to suggest that I skip this episode, but I just never cottoned onto the fact that he actually tries to, you know, he tries to marry his daughter off to Picard as the owner of the vessel.
Yeah. Yeah, you must be rich to own a thing like this. I don't own a commander. Ah. Well, I happen to have a daughter. No. Felicitations. No, but Worf will take her. Oh, man. Brenna O'Dell and Worf. What do you think of that interaction?
I think that, I mean, that whole scene with the alcohol and the kids going to school and Brenna O'Dell. It's all character, right? It's all just establishing what the character of these Bringloidy are like. And it seems like that's the one scene that you could have dropped, and you could have dropped the Worf Pulaski stuff to pick up more in this episode about what the actual issues are. But you're right. It's funny.
Mm.
You know, well, if it's anything like babysitting, I'm an authority.
Exactly. You know.
Madam, have you ever thought about a career in security?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think they were kind of funny. She's the only one I've ever seen in the 7-year run that can actually shut Worf down. He actually retreated. It seemed like he just had to get the hell out of there.
You'll get to Kalar in 2 episodes.
Well, yes, but this woman shut him down. Okay. Fire and cargo hold, whatever.
Yeah, what the hell was that thing?
Automated fire system. A force field contains the flame until the remaining oxygen has been consumed.
Ah, yeah. What if I'd been under that thing?
You would have been standing in the fire.
Yeah, well, leaving that aside for the moment, I mean, what would have happened to me?
You would have suffocated and died.
Yeah, sweet mercy.
The bring loiterer in there. Okay, there's a fire in the cargo hold. So what do? They seal the doors to contain the fire. The problem is, the doors are sealed. They also contain the bring loitie. Shouldn't they have been evacuated because of the fire? What was the point of sealing them in with the fire? Nothing?
Yeah, I got nothing. I'm with you. Doesn't make any sense. It's just for comedic effect, I think.
Yeah, I suppose. What the hell was that? Bloody lightning bolts coming down from the ceiling. Yeah.
The description of the fire suppressant system is pretty cool. You know, this is the one of those little technical things that I remember from my childhood first watching this episode. And I'm like, ooh, that's so cool. I think that's also in the tech manual, right, where they talk about the fire. Anyway, just memories.
I wish we could have seen it.
Yeah, I just couldn't afford it, I guess. But we've never seen it, have
we? No, we never saw how a fire is put out.
Well, I mean, even in later seasons of Trek, they've never really shown that concept.
They had extinguishers.
Yeah. And there are enough fires that spontaneously appear on the bridge on numerous episodes, so it's strange that they didn't have anything.
They do have to make passing references from time to time that the fire suppression system's down.
Right.
I remember the episode with the
gravity plate.
Yeah.
Always in
there.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
They also reference, speaking of the technology on the ship, like Riker says that the ship will clean itself. Right? I'm like, how come we never see the little robots that come out and clean the ship? You know,
well, I don't think it's just a Roomba. I think it's more of a, it just disappears thing. It is all just beams it all out.
Well, obviously the ship doesn't clean everything because Riker's quarters are messy.
Ah, that's true. That's a good point. All right. Anyway, the men find their comforts in the bottom of a mug of homebrew. You know, I can believe that. If Brenna O'Dell is any example of an Irish woman, man, homebrew might be the only comfort for the man. My goodness. Can you imagine being married to her? I mean, what? She's like a bipolar personality. One minute she's yelling at Riker. Next thing you know, she's taking her, you know, part of her clothes off.
I don't have anything against the woman, by the way. I think that the situation that she's being placed in, if what we see is typical, seems to be just a bunch of drunkards with nothing to do and effectively no one else stepping forward. So I don't particularly blame the woman that, you know, someone takes control and kind of keeps everyone else in line.
Right.
Again, if we imagine that maybe the colony used to be a lot bigger, but it was really a lot of people died because of the Holocaust that was happening, right? The sun flares. I don't know. Who used to be in charge? I don't... It's... You know, she's stepping up. And, right. She's pretty impressive at it. Hey, do any of you guys have the Blu-ray for this
season? Yeah, I do. Yeah.
I've never seen it, but I was told there's a deleted scene in this episode on the Blu-ray of, like, Riker going up to the bridge right after he and... Brenna.
Yeah.
And he's got this big smile on his face. Have you seen that?
No, I don't. I don't recall that. So I didn't. So whenever I review the show, what I've got a couple of. Well, I've got a digital copy of the Blu-ray that I can, like, you know, stream over to an iPad. but I don't recall that. I think most cases the deleted scenes come in as like, you know, little extras you can go into. I think it's only with A Measure of a Man where they presented like an extended cut as an alternative viewing. So whenever they just have the little things on the side, I tend not to visit them.
I would give you a better perspective. I would every time. It'd be fun to see, actually, the smile on his face after he's done washing our feet.
I mean, did that? What? Why was it necessary for Riker to bed the Irish lady?
Because he can.
Where did that go? That went nowhere.
Yeah, it's just another example of this episode just going crazy places for no reason. Mm-hmm. You know, like, focus on the topic.
Are they human? I mean, why are they called the Bringloidy if they're human?
Bringloidy is the Irish word for dreamers, I believe. I don't know. It's just the name of their colony. And it's actually not explained on screen. They just suddenly start referring to them, like in the captain's log, as Bringloidy.
Yeah.
But it was, they never introduced themselves as Bringloidy.
No.
Okay. You know.
Because then he would have had to have medical clearance to engage in encounters with her if she was an...
Oh.
Imagine Pulaski. Yeah, go for it, bud. It's no problem.
No, Riker doesn't ask for medical clearance.
Oh, no.
Only Ensign Kim ever gets in trouble for not asking for clearance.
You know what would have been funny? Is if he actually got her pregnant.
I'm sure he took...
I don't know.
I'm sure he takes his shots.
Little Irish Riker going around, running around. I don't know. I think it'd be kind of interesting to revisit them in a few years to find out Riker had a baby with her. Because actually, you know, they were supposed to, each woman was supposed to marry three men. Or, no, they're supposed to have three children from three different men. And the fact that one of those is going to be Riker's DNA out of all that population, I don't know.
I mean, we're slightly jumping ahead on that.
Well, yeah, we are, but that's what we do here.
If you want to jump ahead, though, there was a novel that takes 10 years later that revisits this culture and what became of it. But
did they survive, or was everyone killed by past an asteroid the following week?
I actually don't remember a lot of the novel, but I do know that you know, the transition does not work as well as they might have hoped, you know, which is not too surprising. I mean, you get the Bringloidy people who are definitely monogamous, right? I mean, the guy's trying to marry off his daughter and to one husband. It's like, it seemed almost like a central point of his brain is that's the most important thing in his life, is to find the one husband for his daughter. Mm. And then you're going to put him in a society where they have to marry three husbands. It's just, it's bound to fail. Right? And that's the whole problem with the solution at the end of this episode.
Sounds like sounds like Denobula.
Yeah. It does. Maybe they should have a Denobulan cultural exchange.
Mm.
That might have helped those people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I gotta figure out where I'm at on my notes here. We've already been
past Riker's trombone.
Uh-huh.
It was in his quarters.
Well, of course. Yeah,
right, Riker's trombone.
And he used his trombone. So, anyway, foot washing. Ah, boy. So, Odell is complaining that they need to get blitzed to make some pachi. So, Worf takes him to the replicator and starts out with a little whiskey, but that has no bite. So then Worf orders Jahataloop. I'm going to have to find out what that is someday. And whips out a drink that's still smoking when Odell drinks it and almost passes out. I'd like to know what would be in that thing. Any blood or something? I wonder how you take blood wine, do you think?
It's interesting that this is a Klingon beverage that we'd never hear of again. You know, yeah. I mean, blood wine and what's the one like coffee that they drink?
Rectogino, yeah.
And it's just, those show up tons.
Yeah.
But this particular drink just never gets repeated again.
Okay. Well, in the end, I don't think Riker must have satisfied Brenna all that well, because she comes in just spitting up venom again. She even belts Worf one about showing them that magic wall that gave him more than meat and potatoes. Now they never get liquor work out of them.
Jeez Louise. Yet another... Oh, you're getting distracting me with that line, that whole question of, you know, when you're in a society that's a post-scarcity society like the Federation, what does motivate people? I mean, oh man, that's a whole episode by itself that they're just not going to do, right? Anyway, I think Brenna may have liked her time with Riker. This is her in a good mood.
Right.
She's having fun.
Oh, and another thing about in all your travels, have you ever heard anything from the other colony? The other colony? Now, okay, let me see something here. I think I had... Obviously, it was only a half light year away was another colony on a Class M planet that nobody knew about. Wouldn't they have detected that when they were scanning this star system?
It's not in the same. Yes. Wait, it's not in the same system, right? Of course, but you possibly would have seen it. I don't know. I mean, the plot needs them to be told by the Irish guy that they should go and visit them, and that's what happens.
Mm-hmm. But the not other much more than that. The other colony. Okay. Well, anyway, welcome to Mariposa. So come on down. We could really like to extend our hospitality to you, but Deanna says he's hiding something, you know, such as the entire population made up of former pack lads. Or, no, not pack lads. Actually, okay. The entire population was made up of clones.
Clones?
Clones?
Clones.
But by the way, I did like the way that I don't like the way that Troy is treated here, because they engage in the view screen conversation with the guy on the planet. Mm. And then Riker is basically, you know, takes everything at face value. And then Troy says, you know, we have to be careful here. You know, he's hiding something. And then Riker basically says, yeah, sure, I'll handle it. He didn't even ask her, you know, well, what do you mean? You know, what type of thing are you talking about? Can you tell me, give me a general gist? Can you exclude something so I am a bit more prepared? Mm. It was, he literally turned to her and said, yeah, it will be careful. You know, you don't worry your pretty head about it.
At least Troy picked up on something. I mean, she normally doesn't even have that, right? She normally just states the obvious. And at least this was not obvious that he was lying or hiding something, mm-hmm. you know? So, but you're right. I mean, why are they so bad at writing Troy, especially in the early seasons?
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, after 300 years of cloning, I found this funny. The entire concept of sexual reproduction is a little repugnant to the Mariposian. Are they Mariposans or Mariposians or something? But either way, yeah, that's what Mariposa is. But Riker, I'm surprised, you know, Riker wasn't chuckling at the whole idea of the sexual reproduction is a little bit repugnant. Riker had to chimed in and said, "Oh, you should try it.
It must be the drugs.
Yeah.
Whatever drugs they got themselves on to stop their libido. It's just, why are they all eunuchs? Maybe that might help too. Just snip, snip. You know,
neutered and spayed.
All right, before we get too much into that, I just want to mention a couple little things. So." Pulaski serendipitously scans a guy.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe we're led to believe that that's how she figured out he was a clone. But mm-hmm. she didn't look at the device. Mm-mm. I mean, was it auditory? Like, ooh, when it goes, ooh, that means he's a clone. When it goes, that means he's not a clone. I'm like, how was she getting any information from this device that she was serendipitously scanning him with?
Yeah, I think she has like a book of, you know, 42,000 different signals that can come from the top of the tricorder, you know, probe thingy. I didn't pick up on that. I didn't notice that. I assumed that she had a chance to turn away, you know, while the camera wasn't on her and have a look at the the readings. But when you are down there initially with Pulaski, Riker, and Geordi, right? Is it those three, or is it Riker and Worf to begin with?
It's just Riker and Pulaski that go down initially. Geordi's later. We'll get
that. I thought Worf was down there as well at one point. No, but anyway,
Worf was down there. Yes, you're right. I'm sorry.
Pulaski's way ahead of them because you do have the clones thing. And this is after Worf and Riker have seen, you know, quadruplets in their mind. And then stumbled across other people that look like each other. And they've not been able to piece this together. I kind of thought that for someone who apparently knew every single SOS signal out of Earth, he would at least be able to be intelligent enough to cotton on to that it's very unlikely you're going to have these people walking around that are identical.
He doesn't know everything. He doesn't know what the European Agenemy is.
Well, that's true.
I don't know. It was a bit... Why are all these clones the same age anyway? The whole how the cloning works is a bit weird in this episode. I mean, you should be able to clone a being and that new being be a baby and you raise them, right? And like all these clones should be different ages from each other, even though they're from the same genetic material. There should be some diversity in your population, but it's not.
Yeah. True, and also, I mean, I know that the environment might be similar, but if you were to clone, you know, if you do have someone that's genetically identical to yourself and you're raised in a different part of the world or under different circumstances, you look pretty different pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea that you have every single person with the same haircut is a bit far-fetched.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they could have easily swapped some chromosomes and created, you know, a diverse stock anyway, if they wanted to, instead of just doing the five direct clones. It's just the way the cloning works here is, and how fast it is, right? They take samples, and they're apparently clones, almost fully grown, like an hour later, 2 hours later. Do you remember the Deep Space Nine episode, A Man Alone?
Yep.
Where it took them like 3 days to
yeah.
In that episode, the clone did come out fully grown adult, which is weird enough. But at least it took 3 days to grow instead of like an hour, as it appears in the episode. So just different types of cloning.
But Data, what you're forgetting here, of course, is that although that episode had, you know, the dude working in the 24th century with whatever technology they have, what we had here were five scientists from the 22nd century stuck on a planet when half the guys on the shuttle died. So how they even got to the position where they survived is, to be honest, doesn't make sense. And if you are going to, you know, if you do have the five survivors and you're going to now decide that you're going to go ahead and clone, you could have at least cloned the five survivors and, you know, maybe six or seven of their kids.
Mm.
You know, a decent first attempt to get a broader genetic base would have probably seemed sensible, I think.
And the whole about cloning was just the sci-fi twist to this, right? You really could have just had a society with few people, a small society that needed an influx of more people. If all you wanted to talk about was immigration, which is what this episode is supposed to be mostly about, you know, you didn't have to have this clone thing, and it's just creating a lot of issues and questions, like we're getting at here. Yeah.
Okay. I think the thing that makes it slightly cleaner from it being a clone, if it's an issue of if you need resources, I think very quickly you can move into the idea of, you know, there being an upper class, and then you need workers to come, and then that gets you into like a bit of into the discussion of slavery and, you know, ownership of property and that kind of thing. So I think that keep it in terms of clones, as in it might have been an attempt to try to keep the issues cleaner, but I don't particularly think it works.
Well, even with clones, how do you decide which clone is going to be the leader and which clone is going to be your janitor, right? I mean, are all the clones... Like the Eddie Murphy clones on this planet, are they the ones that look like Eddie Murphy? Are they the minority?
I knew I couldn't be the only one who thought that.
Yeah, so it it creates all these problems. I mean, as we know, murdering a clone is still murder. Well, yeah. That's from the Deep Space Nine episode, right? So the way you treat clones, you still have to treat them like people. You can't just say, well, you have to go off and do this job because that's what you were cloned for. So, again, there's just so many questions brought up that aren't dealt with in the episode.
So let's jump ahead because we have to.
Let's jump ahead very quickly to that because I think what happens is that they need DNA. Eventually, they steal DNA from from the Enterprise crew under a bit of subterfuge that they are going to just accept a little bit of help on the side, and then all of a sudden you see Riker, the double murderer, taking out clones. And now I'm probably of the opinion that you shouldn't murder clones, but the episode doesn't even raise it as an issue or even as a potential issue for debate, and I found that strange.
Right.
Go ahead, Lou.
No, I was saying it's exactly what I was going to say. Picard doesn't say anything about those two beings that you just killed.
Yeah. Well, I think the difference might be, if there is a difference, right, that the clones in this episode were not fully formed. They weren't complete. They weren't birthed, right? Mm-mm. Whereas the clone that was killed in the Deep Space Nine episode was walking around. He was completely independent. He was a life form of his own.
Not right. Now, hold on. Before you go any further, I'm going to counter that real quick because a pregnant woman has a right to have an abortion, but you don't have a right to kill her unborn child.
Well, okay, well, obviously that's what this part of the show is about, right? It's abortion rights.
Yeah.
So, Lou, you say a pregnant woman does have a right to abortion. You're already assuming that, right? That is the thing that's under question here, right? And so a pregnant woman, does the father have a right to abort a child that's inside his pregnant woman?
Nope.
Right? We would tend to say no, but there is some rights that the father has over a baby.
No, none.
Or over a child.
Absolutely zero. Until the child is born, the father has absolutely zero rights.
Let's say, for instance, my wife was pregnant and there was a question of whether or not we were going to do a certain scan on the child, right? Mm-hmm. Like my son, actually, there was a risk of a certain type of genetic defect. And so we had extra endocardiogram scans done of the child before it was too far along in the pregnancy, right?
Right.
Did I have a say in whether that scan would happen because it was my child or not because it was still inside my wife's womb?
No, you don't.
Not mine, right? But these are the questions that could come up.
Yeah.
And I think, like what Snodgrass said or has said at times is that what she was equating the clone thing with was a little more like a sperm donor, right? Mm-hmm. Like a guy who had his sperm stolen from him,
right,
much like Chakotay does. and then he finds out, oh, my sperm's been used for this thing that I didn't agree with. Does that person have any rights? There's a lot of heavy questions here, but you're right. They're just ignored.
Right. I mean, there was a Boston Legal episode that had that, where some woman, kind of did an oral thing on a guy, kept the proceeds from that, and then used it to impregnate herself. And they determined he still had no rights to do anything about it. It was given up to her. And she decided to do what she wanted with it, so therefore he couldn't abort or do anything. He had no rights. So no. Go ahead.
No, so I think we should probably be clear, right, that there is, when people say there are no rights, and there are two issues. There's what we currently live under, and by the way, you guys in the US are going to be living under different laws than we do in the UK,
right,
and other people have around the world. So there's the current legal status, but then there's also perhaps a moral question that underpins it, and then the Star Trek legal side of things. Mm-hmm. And I think even if whichever way the cookie crumbles in any of the countries we currently live, it's probably fair to say that there are probably deep questions to be had on all of this right across the board. And I think the bad thing in the episode is that none of this is brought up. So, you know, you mentioned at the beginning, well, a little back, about how a woman has the right to an abortion. I think that if you had that as an absolute within a Star Trek storyline, I still think that morally you would have to question the decisions being made, even if you did have the right to do so. And I just think that there's no attempt to shine light on any of these questions in this episode.
Here's another thing I was just now thinking of about this. The difference, I think, is because if you impregnate a woman and you try to kill the baby within her, that would be murder. But these, I guess you could call them babies or whatever they were not in another being. They were in a technology, in a drawer. So we already know that fetuses are not life until they're born, is what the law says. So therefore...
I'm not even sure the law says that, but all right. Yeah.
And then even you'd also have to say in the U.S. because in Ireland, I mean, first of all, the abortion laws in Ireland are a lot more strict than in many countries. Mm. And there was recently an instance where there was a clinically dead woman that was kept alive for the sole purpose of allowing the fetus to be delivered and to be born a child,
right,
against the expressed wills of the family of the woman. Mm. So they did not have, you know, even when the woman was dead or medically dead, you weren't able to effectively turn off life support when there was an unborn child around. So there are lots of, I mean, and I'm not saying anything of this stuff is either wrong or right, but there are shades of gray here, and I don't think any of this is brought up.
Well, I'm just saying that maybe because that might be why Riker didn't get in any trouble for it, because it wasn't a life yet. And it wasn't inside another life. It was inside a drawer for all. So maybe that's why he didn't get in any trouble.
You might imagine in this kind of technological society, right? And we're not too far from this right now. What if some people get together and decide to make an Arnold Schwarzenegger in a test tube? Right? I'm talking about twins. Right? Or a clone, right? A clone of a human. Right? And you start developing in a test tube, but after you're letting it develop for a while, you realize, oh, it's messed up, right? It's going to develop improperly, so I want to abort this attempt. I still got some material. I'll just make another one in a separate test tube, right? So then it becomes a question. Whoa, I'm creating life form there that will eventually develop into what we would consider a full-grown sentient adult, maybe with mental deficiencies or something, but that these are the questions of abortion rights, and these are the questions that are not addressed in this episode. But you can understand that. I mean,
yeah.
Star Trek's never done that. I mean, this episode is the closest it ever gets to that topic, as well as the child earlier this season briefly mentioning it.
Okay. Well, anyway, all right, let's go on with the story, because, yeah, we could debate this one for a long time. So Geordi's looking for... looking for Riker and Pulaski, and every time he asks, another clone lies to him. He would have been another opportunity for some fresh DNA. Why didn't the clones pick him? Or, yeah, okay, I could say, why didn't the clones pick him to create new clones?
But wait, one thing that I think is, I don't know if they meant to do this in this episode, but it was something was brought up in the Masterpiece Society, right, when they have the other genetic, the modified people, is that, you know, Geordi being blind and him having been blind through a genetic defect, you know, it may have been the case that he was just shunned for that reason.
Right.
And that's kind of what I kind of took in out of it in the interactions of why Geordi was spared. But it's kind of glossed over. And there's certainly no mention of it in this episode. Whereas at least in the Masterpiece Society, they mention how isn't it ironic that, you know, a person that wouldn't have been born on this planet or would have been, you know, ushered away out of the gene pool, you know, other ways to make their life better effectively solves their problem. And I think that's a much better way of, I think that's a much better episode.
Okay, so cloning isn't the answer. What they need is breeding stock. Did you notice Deanna's expression when the thought of the Bringloidy comes to Picard's mind? It was like, you know how she can detect strong emotions, and when it hit Picard, it was kind of like a light flicked on, and she probably could feel that sudden change in his brain chemistry. Thought, oh, the Bringloidy.
See, she can sense strong emotions and stupid ideas.
Yes.
I think she was having the same idea, because as soon as he says Bringloidy, she says yes.
Right.
I mean, yes. I think she was on the same track. But then she goes on, like, immediately to say that the Mariposans have the technique and, intelligence. I can't remember the other word she used. But then she
drive.
Says
the Bringloidy possess the technological. Yeah, the Bringloidy have the drive, and the Mariposans have the technology.
Oh, the other thing Troy said that the clones had was emotional maturity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Emotional maturity, as if she's implying the Bringloidy don't have emotional maturity. What have we seen the Bringloidy do in this episode? Have sex and drink alcohol. So is Star Trek implying that you can't ever emotionally mature? There's no only mature way to have sex or drink alcohol?
And on the flip side of that, right, the people that have the emotional maturity have lied and stolen.
Yeah, the Bringloidy seem much more straightforward about what they want in life. You know, they're not liars and cheaters.
Mm-mm. No. You're right there.
By the way, it would be remiss of me not to bring up the fact that so we have 220 odd people on one side and we've got five on the other, or at least, you know, five pieces of genetic code. We're not at minimum viable population levels here. And that's even being fair and assuming that the 300 or the 250 that come from the Irish settlement were a very, very sparse genetic pool, which they're probably not, because they've probably been interbreeding themselves. Yeah. So I know they'd like to say, look, you know, this will solve the problem. In reality, you probably need 10, 20 times as many for there to be a chance of survival.
I think what you're trying to say is that being a man in either culture is going to have its perks, you know, pretty soon.
Carry on.
I was just wondering, James, if you were saying that from your any like actual medical knowledge that you have.
I think that typically if you look at things like endangered species, so actually even moving away from humans, if you go down to the endangered species out in the wild and stuff, you would be typically looking at least like the 500 to 1,000 range for there to be like any chance that that's going to continue going forward. And that would be without issues about inbreeding and, you know, there being families and such. And I think a lot of the stuff that has been, I don't know to what extent there are the studies that would back this up, but anecdotally, at least, you do get the impression that humans are, we're more susceptible to inbreeding than other animals are. Maybe it's more complicated or whatever. But if we got to the point where there was only 200 of anything left in the wild, effectively they're gone.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm no expert, but I've done a little. I've read some articles about this and how the whole interbreeding thing's not. I don't believe it's as big a deal as we think it is, and that you can have a society with a small number of people. I mean, there were colonies, failed colonies in the Philippines, where they know they have populated islands today that they can backtrack to, you know, very few survivors. Like 15 people started this island, and now today there's tens of thousands of people living on the island. And so, I mean, my understanding is that the whole idea of inbreeding being bad is not necessarily true, and that you don't necessarily have to have a big population. As long as the population you start with doesn't have any significant or any amount of recessive negatives, right? I mean, the problem with the inbreeding in the English aristocrats, which is, you know, something that you see joked about stereotypically, was that they had genetic failures to begin with. So, of course, you know, when you inbreed, that becomes a problem. But if you don't have a big genetic problem to begin with, then you can get large societies, stable societies from a small number of people. But again, I'm not an expert, so I don't know. I guess we have to bow down to Pulaski's.
Bow down to Pulaski.
In the Star Trek universe, this is true. Whether it's true in real life or not, we don't know.
Okay. Well, anyway, okay, so it's a match made in heaven, but unfortunately it's going to have to be a shotgun wedding. Shotgun? Who would say that in the 24th century? Would he even know what a shotgun is? So it could be a phaser rifle wedding.
I think a lot of... That's fine. Phrases like that stick around way before, after their original meaning.
Yeah.
Gone, right?
Yeah. At least it's not toaster. Or
toaster.
I mean. Or picking nets.
Or picking nets. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
What about blatherskite? Do you think that word's going to stick around a lot?
I don't even know what
it was
means.
In this episode. Was in this episode.
Really? What does it mean?
So which one was it? I didn't catch that.
So right after this, they have the meeting between Granger and Odell, Mr. Odell, right? Mm-hmm. To tell them, hey, we want your colonies to get together. And Odell says, I'm not going to listen to this blatherskite. So it means foolish person, somebody who speaks foolishly. So okay. he was insulting Granger.
Mm. Right.
It's just funny that word is in Star Trek.
Okay. Well then.
And actually, I mean, there are a couple of things I'd like to just point out about this. So we've gone from these people being told that they're not allowed to steal people's DNA, mm-hmm. and, you know, that's not the route to go down, to what looks like a scene that's a little bit too close in my opinion, in my mind, to just the quote-unquote leader of the colony just saying, yeah, sure, we're going to come around and, you know, be prepared to have babies, or the women are going to be prepared to have babies. And I'm not entirely sure that that's, you know, if at least there would have been a passing reference, and I know there's one later to the daughter, but at least if there's a passing reference to the idea that, you know, people have to volunteer for this to go down and to make this a success. And I would have been a lot happier. But instead, they kind of throw the other spanner in the work, which is you're going to be required to have three babies by three different fathers, at least. And again, I'm not, you know, for missions like that, you know, it might be a perfectly good mission for people to go on, but I would much rather if they suggested that there was any choice in this rather than, you know, hey, we're going to send all the women down, we'll have lots of babies. And then, you know, the father figure is sitting there basically looking forward to being able to choose his three wives. And it's a bit, you know, not quite right in my mind.
Okay. All right, so where are we at here?
The Mariposa Society, as we talked about, the kids are born adult. So they've never been children. And they've never been parents. They have a lot to learn.
Do we get an estimate on how large that colony is?
They said cities, right? So, like, more than one city down there. But that's about all we get. We didn't get a number for that.
Hmm. All right, guys. Well, then, is there anything more you want to do before we send in the clones?
Do you know that Send in the Clones was the original title of this episode? And then they changed it to Up the Long Ladder, which is actually a reference to Gallows, which seems like a weird reference. I don't know what that has to do with the episode.
Me neither.
And actually, one thing that I would point out, because I noticed this on StarTrek.com, only around a month ago or so, but the actor that played the lead Irishman recently passed. So that was Barry Ingham. And the guy that played, you know, Odell, so he died recently. He died, I think, just under a month ago, or maybe just over a month ago as this goes out. And actually, I think in general, by the way, I was perfectly, you know, this is a silly episode with a silly Irish stereotype that's kind of put on display. But as far as his performance goes, I thought he did a, you know, perfectly fine job of what, you know, he was probably asked to put onto the screen. So I quite liked that character, and I thought the actor portraying him did a fine job.
Okay, then.
I do have two other little things that we could talk about from this episode. One is Geordi has a truth detector in his visor, right?
Well,
because he can detect, you know, people's heart rates and things like that. There's a part of Geordi's life that is never mentioned again. Can you imagine Will Riker goes in to play poker, right? And who's he playing poker with? He's playing poker with the Iceman, Worf. He's playing pokers with a very fast android who could shuffle the deck of cards without him knowing about it. He's playing poker with the empath who can sense whether or not he's lying. And he's playing poker with Geordi, who apparently can also sense whether or not
he's lying. Through the cards, no less. But he only peeks after the hand.
Actually, come on. Talking about poker, why does Data wear that hat thingy always in poker?
Because that's a stereotype there.
Well, you know, not the hat, but thinking like, you know,
the little visor thing.
Because I always, in my mind, I always assumed it was because he would be able to see the cards otherwise through like a reflection through the light or something like that. So in my mind, I've worked up this idea that that's there to prevent him like peeking what other people have.
No, I don't know about that.
Okay.
I don't know about that.
I think he just does it to have fun.
All right, what's the other thing, Data?
The other thing was, Riker briefly mentions that one Riker is unique. Yeah.
Maybe but special.
100 Rikers, 1,000 yeah. Rikers. And so, obviously, that's funny because there is another Will Riker out there right now. He just doesn't know about
it. I got a feeling you're doing some quotes from Memory Alpha. I got a feeling that's where you're hitting that off of.
Well, I mean, Memory Alpha mentions Thomas Riker, who we'll find out about later. But, you know, Picard's been twinned. We saw that in Times Squared. Data has a twin out there, sort of. So, the whole concept of twinning these characters is not new.
I understand what you're saying, but nobody knew about Tom.
No, I'm not saying they did. I'm just saying, and when we do eventually get to discover Tom, Will Riker does respond the same way. He hates it. He hates being ununique, right? That's a character of his, or that's part of his character that is consistent between this episode and later. You know, like earlier, Granger comes up and asks for DNA, right? Riker's not willing to give it. And by a head nod only, they don't even say anything. Picard and Pulaski also deny to give up DNA. But there's 1,000 other people on board. Maybe there's somebody on board that's willing to give up some DNA.
But two things. One is, Picard said, I think you'll find that attitude prevalent among all the Enterprise crew. And, I mean, let's take a poll here. What about you guys? I'm certainly not interested in having my DNA out there on some strange planet and where they're going to make up clones of me for in perpetuity. I'm not too thrilled about that.
But you did put a lot of provisos on there, including that it was on a strange planet, and they had to be clones in perpetuity. I mean, would the equivalent be like a sperm donor these days? You would probably find enough people within 1,000, within 500, 700 men.
Yeah,
maybe.
They're getting paid for that. I mean, are the Mariposans giving out money for it?
Ooh, I don't think you're paid in the UK.
Well, you are here.
Even without getting paid, I mean, you're helping to continue a society and a culture. I mean, don't the people of the 24th century care about things like that? Right. I don't know. It just seems
How are they going to treat my clone?
Yeah, it's interesting, these allusions to we care about our, well, I mean, we care about what happens to our genetics, right? Mm-hmm. We almost would want to treat a clone of ourselves as if it was our child or something. And Riker talks briefly about that, about how the people of our, you know, humans generally put themselves out there by their children.
Well, it's also another thing is, you know, we have children. They may be a part of us, but they're not us. And someday you never know when your clone is going to want to take over, you know, overthrow a government or a space station and steal a ship.
Oh, another time when Picard was twinned. Good point.
That was Riker.
Yeah, I don't know. Are we afraid that the clones might turn out bad and then that would make us seem worse? We've already talked about how environment has, you know, makes differences. Genetics are just one part of it. It doesn't seem... I guess you just have to put me on the list of people that would not be as perturbed by this. I'm like, sure, whatever, take some of my genes. I'm not doing anything with them.
All right, so that's one. They can have you.
So it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is the worst and 5 is the best. And I'm going to let our guest go first to give us his final thoughts.
I rather like this episode, and I like talking about this episode just because it brings up a lot of different concepts, but it nowhere near deals with those concepts in any great length. It becomes really haphazard, too much in the episode, a bunch of stuff that doesn't need to be there. The director himself said that they were just going bananas on set, just doing a bunch of crazy stuff to fit into this episode. I like the general concept of immigration being good. I mean, Picard says the differences among us is what makes us strong. You know, it's sort of an allusion to the concept of the Itik, which is a very Star Trek thing. But ultimately, this episode is just too haphazard to be that great. So I give it an average 3.
Okay. Doc, who's next? You or me?
Well, let me... Yeah, I'll go next. And actually, one of the reasons why I kind of tried to throw Data under the bus there first is because I think I'm probably going to come in the lowest of us lot here. I don't like this episode at all. I do think that, you know, there's a lot of good stuff that they have nearby that could make interesting discussion points. And that comes up a lot, right? It's, you know, it's not unique for this episode of Star Trek to be dealing with, you know, large topics or interesting topics. I just think that there's so much that just doesn't go anywhere or it doesn't get handled in a proper way. I'm tired about the Irish stereotype as well. I find that very frustrating and something that makes the episode almost kind of unbearable to watch, just because it's, you know, it's so outdated. And I think in the same way that people have problems with Code of Honor about how, you know, how the black people on the planet are portrayed in a very stereotypical way, I think that the Irish far too often get portrayed in, you know, in the stereotypical Irish way. And I think it's no less offensive. I think that we have had a good discussion about what you know, some of the topics they did their best to avoid. And at least it's trying to do something. But I think you have to dig pretty deep. And I don't necessarily think that most people coming out after watching, you know, this hour of Trek will be talking about either abortion rights or about immigration. Immigration in particular, I think, gets dealt with, you know, elsewhere in Trek. And although I can't off the top of my head think about abortion rights, but, you know, I don't particularly see this episode adding a huge amount. Today's an day where I'm probably frustrated that I don't do half points, because this is coming in between a 1 and a 2 for me. Mm. We've had a nice discussion about a lot of this, and maybe that's going to keep it at a 2. But that would be being quite, quite generous in my mind.
Hmm.
So, over to you, Lou.
Okay. Crazy as the story is, there's obviously some kind of moral to the story. Perhaps it is, watch what you clone. You can only clone us so much before you're done. The replicative fading. I thought it was an interesting story. The moral of the story that is that, what, cloning is bad? You know, I got Mr. Mackey. Cloning's bad, okay? Good for a certain amount of time, but anyway. Opposites attract, huh? That's what the story is also about. So, you know, I guess in the end we never discussed what is the end moral of this story supposed to be. We really don't get that. It was just some good, harmless fun. I did chuckle a bit during the story. The overdone cliche of the Irish might have been a little hard for some to swallow, but I thought it was all pretty much in good fun. If they decided to do a whole Italian mafia bit, I'd be okay with that. So I hope our Irish listeners don't get the impression that I'm cool with them being exploited at a ridiculous level. They made it to be fun. I'm not sure, although, you know, where a pregnant Irish woman would be standing behind a wooden fence as if she was some animal on exhibit at the zoo. I don't know if you guys noticed that. That was something I wanted to bring up, and I didn't do that. While she was holding a goat. So I thought that was a little silly. I mean, a lot of these people were standing behind wooden fences as if they were on display at the zoo. So, who in the end, when they put these two civilizations together, who was going to be in charge? Granger or Brenna? Because they have strong personalities. Is she going to be like the second in command of the new Bringloidy Mariposa Society? Or even what will it be called? There's a lot of unanswered questions, and since we never visit them again, I think that's another missed opportunity. So I did ask, what would happen if Riker actually impregnated Brenna with his foot-washing skills? So it would alter the genetic makeup of their society in a little bit. It's not the best episode. It's not the worst episode. There are some technical aspects that make it unique to Star Trek, the universe, with the cloning and replicative fading. Our own ability to clone doesn't come close to the Mariposians, or whatever they would call, plural. So if we were to start mass cloning, I'm sure the same thing might happen to us. Thank goodness we don't. Riker and Pulaski are assaulted for the genetic material and want to have all the equipment inspected for the missing DNA. That was a pretty interesting part, but not enough to push the story to either side. I was thinking about a 2. I was with the doc about a 2. I went into this with a 2. But you know what changed? The debate we had on abortion rights and the discussion we had. And actually, because of that, if it can make us talk like that and put it all out there with each one of us having different societal, I guess you could say, what's legal here may not be legal there and legal there, and what rights do we have over our own body? I don't think if that happened here in today's world, in America, that Riker could have just simply pulled out a phaser and destroyed it. So that's a good debate we had. So now I'm going to give it a 3 because of that.
This is the thing I like most about Trek, and that's generally the type of episodes that I enjoy coming on and discussing with you guys. The episodes that ask questions, or at least make you think about things, even if they don't do it very well, right? It's the asking questions that I like about Trek.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I wasn't even prepared to go into a whole abortion debate and whether he had the right to actually murder him, his clone or her clone. Because, I mean, he looked at her like, you know, do you want me to do this? And she shook her head yes, like, go ahead. But then when the moment came, she turned her head. She couldn't see. So, yeah, these were some interesting debates.
Next time on Star Trek, The Next Generation, Counselor Troi's mother is on a manhunt for a new husband.
A Betazoid woman, when she goes through this phase, quadruples her sex drive.
Now, Picard's hiding in the holodeck to escape wedlock.
Perhaps we should consider my alternate plan.
Riker is the next man she hopes to seduce.
Married? Until death us do part.
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Okay, so join us next week as we review Season 2, Episode 19, and that would be Manhunt. isn't that the Loxana Troi one?
It is indeed.
This is going to be either stupid or funny, depending on your philosophical bent. So join us next week, and we will thank you again for downloading and listening to tonight's show. And thank you, Data, for coming on. We will see you again for Who Watches the Watchers? Season 3. We've got you on for your 3 episodes.
Thanks, guys.
All right, take care and good night, all.
Good night.